loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the European Court of Human Rights has found that both Lithuania and Romania violated the European Union's prohibition on torture. The two countries were found to have violated the rights of terror suspects who were tortured in CIA-operated black sites that were set up during the Bush administration. Next, the Virginia State Senate approved a bill yesterday expanding Medicare coverage to 400,000 low-income residents, putting an end to years of Republican opposition. The State Assembly had already approved the measure, and Governor Ralph Northam said he would sign it into law as soon as it reached his desk. Then we continue our discussion on electronic monitoring on recently released prisoners. Electronic monitoring is a popular government alternative to prison, but it discriminates against the poor who simply can't afford to pay for the service. And if they don't pay, they go right back to prison. And then President Trump today pardoned conservative political commentator Dinesh D'Souza, who was convicted in 2014 of violating campaign finance laws. Trump said that D'Souza was, quote, treated very unfairly by our government, unquote. The move was applauded by conservatives on Capitol Hill. He's also reportedly considering a pardon for Martha Stewart and a commutation for Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. And finally, Karl Marx famously wrote that history repeats itself, first as tragedy and then as farce. The Cold War was a tragedy. The new Cold War is playing out as farce. That's the thesis of Dr. Jeremy Kuzmarov in his new book, The Russians Are Coming Again, which you can get from Monthly Review Press and Amazon.com. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the decision by the European Court of Human Rights, which has found that both Lithuania and Romania violated the EU's prohibition on torture. The two countries were found to have violated the rights of terror suspects who were tortured in CIA-operated black sites that were set up during the Bush administration. We're joined from Virginia by Ray McGovern. Ray is a former CIA analyst turned political activist and journalist. Ray McGovern, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thank you, Brian.
What's your take? The European Court of Human Rights has found that both Lithuania and Romania violated EU's prohibitions on torture. Go ahead.
Well, it takes the judiciary a little while longer than the rest of us to rule on these things, but this is a very important decision. We had known about the sites in Lithuania and Romania and Poland, for that matter, as well as in Thailand, for years. Here is the European Court ruling that these people were tortured, and that violates the European Council of Human Rights and other laws under the EU. So, you know, what we have here really is a situation where vassal states, and I use that term advisedly, vassal states of the United States, Poland, Lithuania, you know, the others that were dragooned into accepting our rendered kidnapped prisoners for extraordinary techniques, torture. This shows the very close relationship between the intelligence services of these states and the tremendous clout that our governments have one with the other. This, of course, should not be. And the irony here is, well, first of all, this is interesting that it was released yesterday. Okay, well, why yesterday? Why not 3 weeks ago before Gina Haspel, who ran one of these sites, the first one in Thailand, before she was confirmed as the new head of the CIA, God help us. So the timing was very interesting. Now we know that she will not be able to travel to Europe without fear of being apprehended as soon as she touches down in any European capital worth its salt, maybe not Lithuania, Poland, or the others, but she's under the principle of universal jurisdiction. These other governments are not only allowed, but they are bound under international law to arrest her and bring her to trial. So you have the unlikely prospect of the head of the CIA not being able to travel abroad to meet counterparts in friendly services.
That's the voice of Ray McGovern. Ray McGovern was a longtime CIA official. He was the briefer, the morning briefer for George H.W. Bush. Ray has been, since he left the CIA, noted all around the world for his activism and his journalism, his truth-telling, his support for and advocacy for other whistleblowers. Ray McGovern, I want to read from the BBC. This is BBC 4 hours ago. Lithuania and Romania complicit in CIA torture, says European court. And I'm going to read a few sentences because I think it provides context for our audience. European judges have ruled that Lithuania and Romania violated the rights of two Al-Qaeda terror suspects by allowing the CIA to torture them. The U.S. captured Abu Zubaydah and Abd al-Rahim al-Nashiri after the September 2001 attacks in the U.S., and they are now at Guantanamo Bay Prison in Cuba. The CIA operated secret prisons, including in Lithuania and Romania. The European Court of Human Rights, the ECHR, said both countries had violated the European prohibition on torture. And the same court issued a similar ruling against Poland in 2014. And final two sentences, Lithuania and Romania were ordered to pay up to 100,000 euros, that's $117,000, in damages each to Abu Zubaydah and to the other prisoner, respectively. The ECHR court officials were unable to visit the suspects at Guantanamo. The existence of the so-called CIA black sites for interrogation under the so-called secret rendition policy was kept secret for many years after September 11th. Ray, it was secret. I mean, here is the U.S. government engaged in systematic violations of international law and a violation of U.S. law, not to mention ethical and moral strictures or a sense of basic human decency. And it was only whistleblowers who actually told the truth. I mean, we wouldn't even perhaps know about this if it wasn't for whistleblowers and whistleblowers like John Kiriakou, who were then the focus of prosecution. Here, Lithuania and Romania are being fined $117,000, and they're supposed to go to Abu Zubaydah. Of course, he'll never see that money. Anyway, go ahead, Ray.
Well, that's just it. You know, the notion that reimbursement, so to speak, would ever reach these two fellows in Guantanamo is ridiculous. You know, we have to sort of take five steps back. I talked about a vassal state, and that's exactly what we have in these countries, Poland, Romania, and Lithuania, and in Europe. Ironically, they're the most anti-Russian states. Now, that has historical roots, but also, you know, the Russians, at least, they didn't have much respect in the Soviet days for habeas corpus, but they had Siberia. You know, they just dragged them out there and put them in Siberia. But no, us, we're ostensibly honoring international law because once a prisoner or once a detainee sets his or her foot on U.S. soil, well, then there is habeas corpus. Then there are certain rights. I saw the Solicitor General of the United States complain bitterly against some judge that wanted to let these people come to the United States. He said, no, once they come to the United States, they have rights. Okay, so these people are beyond the pale. Now, how did it get that way? It's worth reviewing. What happened was Dick Cheney's lawyer, a fellow named David Addington, who wrote sentences for Alberto Gonzalez, he could never compose a compound sentence. So Addington wrote this memo for George W. Bush to sign. And it squared a circle. It said, look, we know about the Geneva Conventions. The date, of course, was February 7, 2002. We know about the Geneva Conventions, but we're going to exempt. And Mr. President, you can exempt this. And so President Bush exempts a whole category of detainees from decades of prisoner of war rules. Okay, what does he say? Well, he says that we're going to treat them, and this is a direct quote, we shall treat detainees not subject to habeas corpus or the Geneva Conventions, quote, we shall treat detainees humanely, comma, as appropriate, comma, and as consistent with military necessity, period, end quote. That set the stage. The CIA lawyers got busy drawing up a list of what they called enhanced interrogation techniques. Now, your listeners should know that that's a direct translation of Verschärfte Vernehmung, which is the title of the Gestapo Manual chapter on enhanced interrogation techniques. The Schaft is enhanced vernehmung interrogation techniques. And guess what? The same techniques, most of them used by the Gestapo, were used under these enhanced interrogation techniques rubrics. So, you know, this is not something that our country should be proud of. What it reveals with respect to the Europeans, or, you know, the 50, well, how shameful, 50 other countries in the world were persuaded to cooperate in this kidnapping and torture program. That shows not only the depths to which the United States went down, but also the vassal state, the money that goes to the security services and some of the governments of these states, 50 of them cooperated in this. So when Al Nashiri, he's the one that was waterboarded directly under Gina Haspel in Thailand, and that is clear from the records. He's in Guantanamo now, and the doctors and his lawyers say he's a ghost. He's completely damaged. He doesn't know which end is up. He's completely ruined, and that's what you get from these enhanced interrogation techniques that really were developed first and foremost by the Gestapo, which I suppose learned it from the Spanish Inquisition, but refined them into enhanced ones.
Ray, we have about 20 seconds left. I want to ask you real quickly, is there any real recourse here? Is this going to change anything in any way?
Not unless the word gets out to the American people how shameful this is. Hollywood and TV industry have shown or persuaded most people that torture works. That's a lie. Torture only works if you want inaccurate information that you can use to start a war. That's not theoretical. That's exactly what happened to one of the sources.
We're going to leave it there. We've been joined from Virginia by Ray McGovern. Ray is a former CIA analyst turned political activist and journalist. You can read his writings at raymcgovern.com. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Virginia State Senate approved a bill yesterday expanding Medicaid coverage to 400,000 low-income residents, putting an end to years of Republican opposition. The State Assembly had already approved the measure, and Governor Ralph Northam said that he would sign it into law as soon as it reaches his desk. We're joined in studio by Leo Cuello, an attorney and the Director of Health Policy for the National Health Law Program. Leo, good to see you again.
Thanks for having me back, guys.
So what exactly does this mean for lower-income Virginians?
So obviously, Medicaid expansion will be a huge victory for many of the lower-income individuals who will gain coverage. You're looking at about 300,000 to 400,000 people in Virginia who are currently, many of whom are not currently covered in any way, who are going to be able to get covered under the Medicaid expansion. These are real people whose lives are going to become dramatically more secure in terms of health, more secure in terms of their finances. And remember that Medicaid expansion isn't just a victory for individuals, but it shores up the state's safety net, right? Hospitals, which are currently taking care of people who show up without insurance and the hospitals lose money on that uncompensated care, they're suddenly going to be getting paid for providing that care. So that's good for everybody in Virginia who needs to use that hospital because their hospitals don't get bankrupt. And it's ultimately an influx of billions of dollars into the state, which of federal dollars into the state of Virginia. So there is a lot of positive to say. I think we'll have some negatives to talk about too about it. But, you know, you can start by saying these are 300,000 people whose lives are going to be dramatically improved.
You know, the interesting thing too is that the Republicans still control both houses of the Virginia legislature, the House or the Assembly, I should say, by only one seat. But the Republicans are still pretty solidly in control of the Senate. And what appears to have happened is that moderate Republicans have decided that this really is the way to go, that poor Virginians should not be without medical care. I wonder if this is a model for the rest of the country.
Yeah, I mean, so I actually think that what happened here is November of last year, where they got shellacked. They had 66 seats in the equivalent of the House of Representatives in the state of Virginia. They had 66. The opposition had 34, and now it's 51-49. Healthcare was a dominant issue in that election. It was an important issue in that election. they basically kept control of the Virginia House by the skin of their teeth, and the Republicans also kept control of the Senate, again, by the skin of their teeth, 21 to 19. They saw the writing on the wall, I think, that, you know, the public is in favor of this. And you have to look at what's going on in other states, right? Much more conservative states. Utah, Idaho, and Nebraska all have ballot initiatives that are moving forward for this November, where they are going to put Medicaid expansion up for a vote. And the polling shows that in Utah, support is over 60%. In Idaho, it's over 70%. In Virginia, the polling that I saw a few years ago had Virginia over 60% in support. So this is a losing issue for Republicans if they keep lining up against Medicaid.
And these Western states that you're talking about, Idaho and Kansas and Utah, these are among the most Republican states in the country. These are states that haven't voted for a Democratic presidential nominee. Well, in the case of Utah and Kansas since the election of 1936.
Yeah, I mean, that's an amazing fact, right, when you think about it. And I think that takes you a little bit to the negative side of what happened in Virginia, which is that Virginia is an extremely purple state, right? The Democrats control the north of the state, the Republicans control the south of the state. And so it is a state that, left to its own devices, would have expanded Medicaid fully the right way over the next years. Maybe it would have taken 2 years, maybe it would have taken five, but it would have happened. Instead, what they've done here is moved forward through legislation, and we should say none of this is a done deal yet. The governor has to sign it, and then CMS would have to approve the waivers. But what they are doing is saying, we're going to expand Medicaid and then pursue waivers. And we've talked about waivers in the past, waivers for work requirements, lockouts, premiums, and copays. So what you have, according to some estimates, is about 50,000 people who would have gotten covered if they did Medicaid expansion the way it's supposed to be done under the law, who will not get covered because of the fact that they're doing this through these waivers. So it's a very difficult balancing act, because on the one hand, you do have, you know, something like 300, 350,000 people are going to gain coverage, but you have 50,000 people who should have gotten coverage but will not. And this sets a precedent for other states, right? We know in Kentucky, 100,000 people didn't get coverage. They approved those similar waivers in other states as well. And so what we're saying is, yeah, we're going to gain 300,000 people in Virginia, but these policies are going to result in many more hundreds of thousands of people losing coverage across the country. So it is a very bittersweet sort of situation.
So important, and you don't get that from the headlines at all. So the waivers are, people have to prove that they're working or they're in school. They have to fill out paperwork. They have to do it not once, but they have to kind of have a regular reporting regime. I mean, things that are onerous, they're onerous for all of us, but especially if you're low income, if you're barely making ends meet or not making ends meet, you miss a deadline, you don't do the paperwork, boom, you're off, you're gone, right?
That's exactly what it boils down to. And then, of course, some people will be locked out based on that, so they actually can't get back into the program. And then you also have premiums, and so some people get knocked out because of the premiums, and you have copays, meaning some people won't get higher. They're saying they're going to have higher copays, meaning some people won't be able to actually use their health care because they don't have the copay on them at the time. So what you are doing is essentially kind of putting brakes on something that really could move the state forward. So it's really disappointing to see.
Let's go. I mean, because this works for everybody, as Leo said in the beginning, brings more money into the state, billions, gives poor people who don't have health care, which should be just a fundamental human right, including their kids. It also it eases the burden on health care providers like hospitals, which, if they're taking people who have no insurance, they have to bear that cost. It works for everybody, right? Like, why would anybody be against this?
Yeah,
why would anybody
right.
try to put a sort of a hamstring this thing in the beginning? Leo, how is it supposed to act? Because it's part of the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, Medicaid expansion, that some of these retrograde states, many actually, said no to, but just talk about how it was supposed to work and what the formula was.
So it was supposed to be a mandatory new category of Medicaid that every state was required to do. The Supreme Court stepped in and said, no, we're not going to allow HHS to force every state to do it. So states basically get to choose whether they want to do it or not. 32 states have already said yes. This will be state number 33 if it happens, and it looks like it will. So, you know, the vast majority of the states has figured out this is a good deal. The reason for that is that the funding for this expansion is overwhelmingly coming from the federal government. So from the point of view of the state, this year the state's getting 93% of the money from the federal government to fund this. Next year, it will be 90%, and it stays at 90% in perpetuity. So if you want to talk about people who are really disingenuous, you have legislators on the right in Virginia arguing they didn't want to do the full expansion the right way because it was too expensive when, number one, 90% of the cost is being paid by the federal government, so the state's only paying 10% of the cost, and number two, the 10% of the cost being paid by the state is actually being paid by providers in the state who are taking on a new tax and willingly taking on that new tax because they realize that this is a much better system for them to have than a system where they so there's literally no money, to my knowledge, there's no money that's going to be coming out of the state budget with the exception of, you know, some administrative costs for administering this. But those costs are far outweighed by the costs that they will have to pay to administer the work mandate, the premiums, the lockouts, right? So it's just it's an incredibly bad idea.
Stupid. It's a stupid, it's an ideological position.
It is, because there's no practical downside to this.
Yeah, it's ideological by these right-wing politicians who themselves have adequate health care, and most of them are very affluent and well-to-do. It's like an ideological position of venom and hatred and demonizing of poor people and somehow blaming them and saying, look, you don't really deserve health care, and if you do, or if we think you do, you have to jump through all of these hoops over and over and over again. It's an ideological position.
Yeah, and it's actually very inconsistent because of the fact that the Medicaid expansion income limit goes up to 138% of the federal poverty level. A family of four where the mother or father is working full time at a minimum wage job is way below that mark.
Sure they are.
So in other words, we're not just talking about their stereotypes. We're talking about the people that they actually pitch their campaign around, working families. This is essentially health coverage for working families who don't have a job that offers them health insurance.
And who frankly always have jobs that it's a lot more arduous. It's a lot more work than all the politicians who
actually don't
do any work, but are glad to demonize poor people. That's really what's going on. Leo, what happens next? Obviously, as you said, this has got pluses and minuses. The plus is 300,000 more people will get health care. That's important, super important, especially for those families. On the other hand, it's a step back from the Affordable Care Act, which itself already had limitations. It's a step back if it becomes the model.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And what's most troubling, in fact, is that this is not the model, because this is the only situation where we have a state taking these waivers in exchange for actually doing a new Medicaid expansion. All the other states, Kentucky, Arkansas, Indiana, New Hampshire, these are states that already had expanded Medicaid. Nobody was gaining coverage. So this is the best example that you can put on their side, and it's still totally nonsensical.
Leo, before we leave, how do people learn about the National Health Law Program?
You can go to our website, www.healthlaw.org.
That's easy enough. www.healthlaw.org. That was the voice of Leo Cuello. He joined us in the studio. He's an attorney and the director of health policy for the National Health Law Program. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
We are continuing our discussion on electronic monitoring on recently released prisoners. Electronic monitoring is a popular government alternative to prison, but it discriminates against the poor who simply can't afford to pay for the service. And if they don't pay, they go right back to prison. We're joined from Urbana, Illinois by James Kilgore. He's a research scholar at the Center for African Studies at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, who also focuses on electronic monitoring and supervision at challengingecarceration.org. He also wrote the book Understanding Mass Incarceration, A People's Guide to the Key Civil Rights Struggle of Our Time, and he spent 6.5 years in federal and state prisons. James, welcome back.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
James, there's a bigger issue at play here, and that's the issue of mass surveillance. We have found ourselves, really post 9/11 mostly, in a mass surveillance state. These electronic monitoring devices don't operate in a vacuum. They collect data, they transmit data, and they generate a lot of metadata. Talk about that.
Yes, I mean, this is one of the big changes in electronic monitors, say, since right after 9/11. In 2005, 5% of the devices had GPS capacity, that is the capacity to track people's location. Now it's over 70% and steadily increasing. And the technology is also developing. So we still have the classic kind of ankle shackles, but we're also getting wrist shackles. We're getting things that are cell phone based. And I think we can see that this technology is changing rapidly, just as cell phone technology is changing rapidly. So what happens with GPS is that your every movement is tracked and it's stored on a cloud somewhere. And when you request movement, it's for a specific period of time. And you, in most cases, have to say exactly where you're going. Sometimes if you're going to someone's house, you have to specify who that person is, and you have to indicate that you've told them that you're on parole and that you're on this tracking device. But all of this is stored, and we don't know what happens to it. Essentially, in Europe, for example, in Germany, all this tracking information needs to be deleted by law after 2 months. Here, we've seen contracts that demand that the data be kept for at least 7 years. Now, we can't imagine anything good that's going to happen from this. And what we know, and I think it's really important to think about surveillance in sort of, you know, class and race terms, that on the one hand, I think middle class people are worried about their cell phones and their emails being read by NSA or something, but they have no real specific fear. It's kind of a generalized fear of what that surveillance might mean. But for poor people who are already in a whole range of criminalized databases, be it from juvenile justice, be it from foster care, be it from immigration, et cetera, all of these things are part of the record that the state already has on them, and now their GPS tracking is yet another set of data that's going to be added, and I suspect as we move down the road, those devices are going to themselves carry a lot more of that data as well.
That's an important point because, yeah, you know, I mean, even when you think about who answers census questions, poor people are understandably worried that the government collecting more data on them is going to be, well, certainly not beneficial to them. It's going to be potentially detrimental to them or even dangerous to them. You have the same reluctance with people even accessing hospitals and going to the doctor and providing other kind of information, because the reality that middle class people and middle class white people don't know about is the constant over policing in all ways of other people and other communities always has a negative impact on those people in those communities. I think James is right. This part of it is completely outside of the consciousness, at least of some parts of what of a population that might think of itself as liberal, as skeptical about the surveillance state, but not dealing with the everyday, day-to-day threats and consequences of that state.
Yes, Brian, and I think also we find that, in fact, those very middle-class people kind of respond by saying, why are you surveilling me? I'm not doing anything. It's those people over there you ought to be looking at.
Right.
So not only do they not like it happening to them, but they don't really have a problem with it doing with it with them surveilling the criminalized sector of the population. And I think, I mean, one of the things that we campaign a lot against in challenging incarceration is the widening of the net, because I try to think of myself as if I were the CEO of BI, the biggest electronic monitoring company, where would I be looking to market my product? And I'd be looking at groups that I think are marginalized, are vulnerable, and who don't have much political power to fight back against being targeted with surveillance. So we have 4.5 million people on parole, probation, all those forms of what they call community supervision. That's a big pool, and there might only be 100, 200,000 of those people on electronic monitors at any given time. But then we have more and more immigrants coming into the country who are being put on electronic monitors. But then there's also people that fall into categories like histories of mental illness, histories of being involved in the foster care system, histories of drug usage and substance abuse. Even if they don't have criminal charges, these are suspicious people who probably could, who much of the population might be comfortable with keeping an eye on them through some kinds of surveillance. And as these devices become smaller, as they become more powerful, and I think inevitably they'll become cheaper, I think it's a no-brainer that the companies are going to try to sell them, and we have to fight back against that. So and I think we have to be mindful that it's not only is it the surveillance state, but it's the you know, as they like to call themselves, a public-private partnership of surveillance.
You know, I want to point out too that there's no national policy on these things. This varies, at least at the federal level, judge to judge or district to district. I know here in the Eastern District of Virginia, they rarely use electronic monitoring devices, but there are other federal districts where everybody has to use an electronic monitoring device, regardless of whether you are in pretrial status or you're out on parole or probation. There's no rhyme or reason to who has to do this. It's just up to the whim of whatever judge you happen to be standing in front of.
Right. Well, I mean, in some states, for example, in Illinois, where I live, it's mandated that certain people have to be on electronic monitoring. It's also mandated that certain people with certain sex offenses have to be on lifetime GPS monitoring,
right,
as it is in about 10 states. So there tends to be state legislation which enables monitoring, but doesn't target that specifically what it has to be used for. And then you have, as you're pointing out, it can also be implemented at the local level. And you have an interesting case in Chicago right now where there's a lot of debate over decarceration, because there's been a huge reduction in the population of the Cook County Jail, one of the biggest in the country. And there's now a fight because the judges are ordering people out of the jail onto electronic monitoring, and the sheriff is saying, no, I'm not letting these people out. These people are dangerous. And so we have a whole battle going on about who has the final say. I mean, clearly the judge has the power to make these orders, but we're seeing what I think is part of what we're going to see as the struggle for decarceration heats up. We're going to see pushback from sheriffs in all kinds of different ways, including if there has to be less people in jail, just putting them on very, very strict house arrest. And, you know, like in Cook County, some people do like surprise searches of their house 3 times a day and not allow them out of the house at all.
James Kilgore is our guest. He's a research scholar. We're talking about e-carceration, not incarceration. That's when people are put in jail or prison. E-carceration, where people are electronically imprisoned. E-carceration. And James Kilgore's website, challengingecarceration.org, is something that we want to urge our listeners to go to. E-carceration includes a range of technologies that gather information about the daily lives of individuals who don't have liberty as a consequence. The technologies, James, according to, I'm looking at your website, include license plate readers, stingrays, facial recognition software, and metadata databases, which house information gathered from all of these sources of surveillance. So the surveillance state, we have lots of platforms for surveillance gathering, And now the technology exists to be able to aggregate all of those different things, where you drive on your license plate or with your license or facial recognition. It's a kind of power, we only have 45 seconds left, a kind of power that hasn't really quite existed before. The national surveillance state is something new, something odious, something dangerous. Go ahead.
Yes, I think that's true. And part of our campaign, I must say that the Center for Media Justice, which hosts the campaign, has done a lot of work on all of those forms of technology. But I think the point that you make is that all of these things are increasingly being aggregated. And we're getting cases, for example, of people who are being penalized in Florida for a cousin in Washington that owes traffic fines or something. So all these databases are coming together and creating a whole range of punishments. So this innocent ankle shackle is increasingly going to be connected to all of those other forms of surveillance that you noted there.
It is. It's just the beginning. That was the voice of James Kilgore. He joined us from Urbana, Illinois. James is a research scholar at the Center for African Studies at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, who also focuses on electronic monitoring and supervision at challengingecarceration.org. He wrote the book Understanding Mass Incarceration, A People's Guide to the Key Civil Rights Struggle of Our Time, and he spent 6.5 years in federal and state prisons. We have a lot more coming up. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
President Trump today pardoned conservative political commentator Dinesh D'Souza, who was convicted in 2014 of violating campaign finance laws. Trump said that D'Souza was, quote, treated very unfairly by our government, unquote. The move was applauded by conservatives on Capitol Hill. The president is also reportedly considering a pardon for Martha Stewart and a commutation for former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. We're joined from New York by Ted Rall. He's an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. Welcome back, Ted.
Thank you.
Ted, this president is very unusual in that he's just pardoning people, it seems, all the time. He's not doing what most other presidents do and wait for a lame duck period after an election. These obviously are political pardons, but what should we be making of it?
Well, he's a random guy, and his policy pronouncements tend to not follow precedent. I don't think he much cares about the idea that that this is the way things have always been done in the past, and therefore they should be done this way. Personally, I'm going to take issue with some of the choices of these pardons, but I do think that it's pretty clear that presidential pardon powers have been woefully underutilized for quite a long time. I think the most major mass pardon that occurred in my memory, in my lifetime, was Jimmy Carter's decision to allow the draft dodgers from the Vietnam era to come back home. And I think that was great, you know, and it hasn't happened much. President Obama had a terrible record when it came to pardons.
One of the worst in modern times, actually.
So it's great to see some pardons happening. Let's just have more of them and better ones.
Yeah, there was an interesting piece in the Washington Post today talking about the recent pardon of Jack Johnson, the famous boxer, who was convicted more than a century ago of violating the Mann Act just because he had a white girlfriend. And the Post made the point that both Barack Obama and George W. Bush refused to pardon Jack Johnson. So
crazy.
It's crazy. I don't see any downside whatsoever to being on the right side of history on this issue. And then of all people, it's Donald Trump who does it.
It's weird. And, I applaud President Trump for that decision. Indeed, it's weird that so many of Trump's predecessors have seen it as something they didn't want to do. There's not a lot of risk. I think the Mark Rich pardon by President Clinton was viewed as being it was pretty unpopular. But even so, I don't think it's much singed him or hurt his overall popularity. Now, it's an opportunity for a president to show some mercy, be benevolent, and exercise presidential power in a positive way. Why not do it more often?
Mark Rich was a super millionaire hedge fund,
illegal oil trader.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And How much money did he give the Clintons?
Oh, it was millions of dollars that he and his ex-wife raised for the Clintons. Even though he was in self-imposed exile in Switzerland, they raised millions of dollars for the Clintons.
Doesn't that mean he was in flight, in other words?
Oh, yes.
In other words, he'd
been sentenced to absentia.
He was a fugitive. He was a fugitive, and yet with enough money, you can possibly be pardoned. Is it about money?
Well, I think it's about money, and I think it's about, for this president, it's about making a splash. He likes to be in the news. Whatever the center of the conversation is, he wants to be right there. It's hard to, the magnetic attraction of a microphone or a camera and to Donald Trump is impossible to overstate. I think that, you know, with the Boxer pardon, for example, that was something that people were talking about on Twitter. So that's why he got involved.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the pardon of Dinesh D'Souza, right wing commentator, and he was convicted of illegal financial contributions for the Republican Party, right?
Yeah, that's right. What he did was something that is actually quite common, which is violating the $10,000 campaign contribution limit by setting up shell corporations, fake companies, fake entities, so that he was able to funnel sums under $10,000 each, but that totaled more than $10,000 to a candidate. A lot of people do this, but also a lot of people get caught and prosecuted for doing it. So this is one of those cases where you could really argue this either way. But what one would really want to see, I think, are classes of commutations and classes of pardons so that there would be consistency, because there are a lot of people who are not conservatives and who are not famous who have been prosecuted for the same exact offense. And they're not going to get any mercy. So why this guy? Just because he's a Trump ally.
And I want to make a point, too, that none of these pardons that we've seen so far in the Trump administration or the Trump presidency have gone through the U.S. pardon attorney. None of them. These are all political actions taken by the president. In fact, in Barack Obama's last year as president, the U.S. pardon attorney didn't recommend a single pardon other than the handful of pardons that were granted as part of the Justice Department's program to relieve people convicted of drug crimes.
So I think this president doesn't really much care about the opinion of his own government. He views himself almost, I think, very much like an authoritarian ruler. He reminds me a lot of the famous dictator of Turkmenistan who died a few years ago and who basically had a hand in every personal decision that was made in the republic, even down to college admissions. And he was constantly issuing edicts and pardons and ordering people jailed individually. He just was kind of trying to run the whole country by himself. And that's what this president feels like. I think it's a result of the fact that he came out of a very small organization centered around him. The Trump Organization doesn't have very many employees, and he's a control freak. He's used to doing everything or having a hand in every decision himself. So he doesn't really care what the U.S. pardon attorney has to say. He's just going to pardon the people that he wants to. And when he asks, hey, can I? And someone says, yeah, you can. He's going to.
Let's talk real quick. We have about 4 minutes left. Martha Stewart, she's going to pardon her. She was convicted of lying. That was a ridiculous trial, too.
Ridiculous.
But she had a feud before with Donald Trump because he was supposed to turn over The Apprentice and she was going to fire him. But then she tried to make up as soon as they won the election. Let's talk about Martha Stewart's a possible pardon, and also the commutation of sentence Rod Blagojevich, former governor of Illinois, as Trump said, 18 years in jail for being stupid and saying things that every other politician, you know, that many other politicians say.
And, you know, with Blagojevich, I followed that case very, very closely. No crime was ever consummated. These were all conspiracy charges. So he didn't actually carry out any kind of crime.
It was like he was using his influence as governor to replace Barack Obama's Senate seat, he wanted.
Exactly.
Go ahead, Ted.
Actually did.
Yeah, it's almost like a prosecution for thought crime. And I agree that Martha Stewart and former Governor Blagojevich ought to be pardoned. I think both of those convictions were travesties. I just think that there's about 20 million drug convicts who should be in line ahead of them.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't mean that he's wrong about this. It's just a really weird case of misplaced priorities.
Trump pardoned Scooter Libby, the former chief of staff to Vice President Dick Cheney, Sheriff Joe Arpaio.
Yeah, that was a travesty.
That one's wrong.
You know who he should pardon? John Kiriakou. What do you think, Ted Rall? I mean, John Kiriakou exposed torture so that the American people knew that the Bush administration was lying. He went to prison for 2 years. You should be pardoned, John. I mean, I'm serious.
Thank you.
If there's going to be any justice here, a pardon would start with John Kiriakou.
I'm trying, but I just don't seem to have a path to this president.
Don't give up. Ted Rall, should John Kiriakou be pardoned?
Count me in, 100%. The only problem here is that exposing torture as wrong doesn't seem to be something that's likely to make you more popular with President Trump.
Unfortunately, no.
Yeah. Okay, but let's talk again. Trump is making waves right now. Martha Stewart, 75 years old. Rod Blagojevich. I mean, you know, some of the people actually just feel Rod Blagojevich is actually a political prisoner in the United States.
Oh, I considered him to be a political prisoner. 14 years for doing essentially nothing. It's just too much. You know, Jeffrey Sterling, the CIA officer who spent 2.5 years in prison in Colorado, was in the same prison with Blagojevich. And he said Blagojevich was utterly broken. His job was to wash dishes in the cafeteria. And he was just morally and mentally broken.
Ted Rall, 1 minute left. Go ahead. You get the last word.
What happened to Blagojevich is just absolutely insane. Most people haven't followed the case closely, but like John, I did too. And I just couldn't believe that what happened. I mean, this guy got recorded basically just doing standard political horse trading and threatening, standard machine politics, patronage, that kind of thing. That's all it was. Every single governor has done this. They should all be in jail if he's in jail.
I think we're going to leave it there, Ted.
Agreed. Yep. We were joined from New York by Ted Rall. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. So stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Karl Marx famously wrote that history repeats itself, first as tragedy and then as farce. The Cold War was a tragedy. The new Cold War is playing out as farce. That's the thesis of Dr. Jeremy Kuzmarov in his new book, The Russians Are Coming Again, which you can get from Monthly Review Press and at Amazon.com. He joins us today from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Jeremy Kuzmarov is an author and assistant professor of American history at the University of Tulsa. Jeremy, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Jeremy, the book is very timely. It's been a very long time since U.S.-Russian relations were at this kind of a low. What made you want to write this book in the first place?
Well, I think, you know, just following the media and seeing all these sensationalistic stories pervading the news just constant bombardment of accusations directed against Vladimir Putin, against the Russians for election hacking. And to try and remind people of just of the history, how the United States has often antagonized Russia, that the United States actually invaded Russia. And, you know, the Russian threat has always been exaggerated and elevated. And Russia has been a convenient bogeyman, not just in the present day, but historically. And fortunately, we see history repeating itself.
You mentioned that the U.S. invaded Russia. You want to talk about that?
Sure, yeah. There's a chapter in the book. In 1918, very few Americans know about this. It's kind of buried in the memory hole for good reason, because it really was a horrible intervention. The Wilson administration very secretly sent U.S. troops from the European theater of World War One into Russia in support of the white counter-revolutionary armies, and supported some of the most reactionary elements in Russia at that time. We're basically trying to restore the czarist regime to fight the Bolsheviks. And the U.S., was part of a broad coalition with Britain, France, even Japan. And they committed a lot of atrocities. They were supporting some very vicious factions in Russia. And they made a lot more Bolsheviks, just from their presence. It was really kind of an embarrassment. Even the leading commanding general, William S. Graves, is a Texan, he started criticizing Wilson because he thought originally his mission was just to promote neutrality and to protect certain, you know, property interests in the Czech Legion. But when he found he was enmeshed in the counter-revolutionary policy and it had intervened in another country's civil war, he got very upset. But the FBI, basically, he was hounded by the FBI after, you know, and they didn't listen to him. So that's just indicative. This was a kind of really ugly episode in U.S. history.
Yeah, it's 100 years ago. But, you know, I'm glad you mentioned it, and I'm glad you have a chapter in your book. Most Americans don't know what the U.S., along with 14 other foreign armies, did invade Russia following the Russian Revolution in October. And their main beef with the Russian Revolution, I mean, which was obviously led by socialists and communists and Lenin, was that they the Russian revolutionaries, insisted that Russia was leaving the war. It was an anti-war revolution. They left the alliance between America, Britain, and France. The U.S. and the Allies felt that was a betrayal because it freed up Germany from having to fight on two fronts at the same time. But the Russian Revolution was serious about ending that war. They did end the war. But during that period that you're talking about, this is important, and again, Americans don't know it, between 1918 and 1920, after World War I was over, and about 3 million Russians died in that war, another 3 million Russians died during that period because of the American and foreign invasion of Russia, along with the former Tsarist military forces who had combined. That's a lot of people, 3 more million people who died.
And that's certainly not taught in American history classes.
I would say 1 out of every 100 Americans knows about that. Anyway, Jeremy, I'm glad you included that in your book. Let's talk, though, about the new Cold War. What makes this new Cold War, the Russians are coming again, is the title of your book, what makes this new Cold War different, say, than the tragic Cold War? What makes this farcical compared to the tragedy of the old Cold War?
Well, the first Cold War was a tragedy. Yeah, there was terrible human costs. It diverted social spending into a very destructive arms race. It led to proxy wars. It arguably skewed American democracy and the American political economy. It could be argued as more of a tragedy. I mean, there was ideological divisions between the United States and Soviet Union. There was some truth, although there was a lot of exaggeration and demonization of the Soviet Union. There was some truth, given that Stalin, you know, had the Gulag. So, you know, there was some aspect of the evil empire that was true. In this Cold War, we see the complete demonization of Vladimir Putin without much evidence that he's done anything terrible. In fact, you know, Russia is doing a lot better under his rule than under Boris Yeltsin. A lot of the Russian interventions are more in response to Western provocations, like in Ukraine. So there's no real reason to hold a vendetta against Putin, except that he's making Russia stronger, maybe challenging certain U.S. interests in the region. So that in itself is farcical. And then there's the attempt to, there's no real reason for a new Cold War. And then there's the attempt to, you know, make, like, Donald Trump as this Manchurian candidate when no evidence has emerged that's the case. And, you know, Donald Trump is he's an American original, American arch capitalist, you know, an imperialist with all the bluster of the American character. To make like he's some kind of Manchurian candidate, I think, is ridiculous. And to accuse people like Jeff Sessions, who's the living embodiment of the Confederacy, and Jared Kushner, you know, Trump's wealthy son-in-law, those insinuations, you know, these are Manchurian-type candidates and Russian agents, is kind of preposterous. And the evidence is, you know, no evidence has come to light with all the brouhaha about the election. When the intelligence agencies released a report, it was farcical. Half the report was attacking RT News Network as a propaganda outlet, and there was only an assessment without any evidence in the report. So it's ridiculous.
Jeremy, you mentioned in the book that that the strategy of the Democratic Party and its corporate backers is demonizing Russia and Putin as a way to challenge Trump. And you said that a minute ago as well. Talk about this role reversal that we're seeing compared to what we saw 30 or 40 years ago.
Yeah, what we saw in the original Cold War was also a political strategy by the Republican Party to regain power. Because, yeah, there's a kind of hidden history is that some of the, some very influential people in the financial elite some with ties to the Republican Party had colluded with the Nazis, and the Democrats were trying to investigate this and prosecute them under Truman. So very quickly, and some of them had committed treason because they engaged in trade with the Nazis after the U.S. had gone to war with Germany in World War II. So they spun things around to start making accusations that the Democrats were traitors. You know, Alger Hiss, who was a key figure in the liberal establishment who had been at Yalta, he was accused of being a traitor and spy, although no evidence has ever come to light to corroborate those allegations. And also the Republicans at that time, you know, were moribund. The Democrats had dominated. The New Deal coalition was very popular. So the Republicans were just looking for something, or kind of desperate, you know, to regain popular support. So they seized on this notion that the Democratic Party was infiltrated by spies. And the Alger Hiss case was crucial to making the case for the U.S. public. But now, yeah, it's kind of role reversal. The Democrats are in trouble politically. They ran a terrible candidate in the last election. So they're the ones now playing the Russia card. And they're making accusations. And the danger is that they're starting to revive some of the methods of McCarthyism, which was a low point in the history of American civil liberties and really shifted the political landscape in the United States to the right. Very dangerously, I think.
Where, Jeremy, do you think this ends? The first Cold War ended with regime change. I mean, the Soviet Union collapsed or imploded or was overthrown, however you want to characterize it. The Soviet government fell. Its allied governments in Eastern and Central Europe also fell. Since that time, those Eastern and European central governments have become, in essence, affixed to an American-dominated sphere of influence led by NATO, the NATO-U.S.-led military alliance. And you sort of see in the propaganda of the United States against Russia that by demonizing Putin, it seems to me that what the U.S. is hoping for is a different government in Russia eventually. Anyway, how do you see it end?
Well, it's hard to predict. You know, historians are notoriously poor at predicting the future.
Well, just like economists predicting the economy. I mean, a record of failure. That's true. Go ahead.
I mean, there's one narrative of, you know, the U.S. empire is starting to decline, you know, and there's a lot of overreach of U.S. policy, and that Putin has actually been a fairly smart and shrewd leader. You know, he's forging alliances with China. He's trying to forge the Eurasian power bloc. So one you know, possible future is that the United States, with its overreach and all its domestic problems, continues to decline, and we'll see the rise of new powers, you know, a genuine multipolar world order led by Russia, and, you know, with Russia and China serving as a counterweight and check on American power and aggression in the world. That could potentially be a positive, I would argue, scenario. And, you know, Central Asia could emerge as a strong, you know, stronger. So that is one possibility that would be, I think, positive for humanity as a whole. I don't know. As far as the United States, I think the Democrats, you know, may be playing a losing card because a lot of the public is wary. Since Mueller hasn't produced much and his investigation has gone on for so long, a lot of people feel, you know, it's just further discrediting the Democratic Party. So that could allow for Trump's reelection. And, you know, the United States is moving in a very dangerous direction towards more authoritarianism, kind of pseudo-fascism. A lot of these social services are being gutted. So the future for the United States looks fairly bleak at this time. There's also the danger of nuclear war escalating. I mean, this, you know, another possibility is a further escalation of you know, nuclear arms race that could even lead to nuclear war with somebody crazy like Trump in power. So that would be a terrible outcome.
We have to leave it there. That was the voice of Dr. Jeremy Kuzmarov. He's an author and assistant professor of American history at the University of Tulsa. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com, as a podcast at iTunes, and now as a podcast at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.